So Neil had mentioned that some people were just, you know, kind of interested to find out more about, you know, what I'm doing. You know, so if there's questions about anything we talked about on, you know, I guess yesterday or the day before, you know, please just let me know. If there's no questions, then I could just, you know, mention something that Neil said that people were specifically curious to hear about, which were caustics. And dark matter caustics. This is a topic which has gotten a bit of attention in the past couple of years, you know, and thanks to some work that I've been doing along with Andrei Kravtsov. So people want to hear about caustics, I can just give you like some brief words about that. Caustics. The caustics that I'll be discussing here, okay, so specifically, you know, so these caustics correspond to the outer boundaries of structures called dark matter halos. This is also called the splashback feature in halos, which has recently been observed and prompted lots of excitement in the simulation and also galaxy communities. You know, so I said that these caustics correspond to the outer boundaries of dark matter halos. So what does that mean? So the first question just is to define what is a halo, because apparently, I mean, like some of you are not really steeped in the lore of nonlinear structure formation. So the answer to what is a halo is actually pretty simple, okay? You know, so a halo is just one of these blobs that you guys see in these n-body simulations. That's like, you know, probably the best definition you can get, okay? You know, so I'm right. So all of you have seen these movies of cosmological n-body simulations where you form this cosmic web that has sheets and filaments and void and all these things forming in it. So halos just correspond to these round-looking blobs that form, so they form at the nodes of the cosmic web between filaments. I could try drawing a cosmic web, but I mean, it'll be terrible. So in the lobby of your building, there's like some little movie showing one of these simulations. And so the movie actually has, you know, nice pictures of the cosmic web and the filaments, and also halos that are forming. And so I'll spare you my inability to draw. I'll just direct you to the movie in your lobby. So halos are just, you know, those round structures, you know, that you see in simulations. That definition might not be adequately precise for your satisfaction. So I can give you a somewhat more precise definition of what we mean by a dark matter halo. Okay, so a halo is just a cosmic structure that is, first of all, gravitationally bound. Also, that is collapsed. Okay, in three dimensions and three axes, 3D, and also that is virialized in some kind of vague sense. Okay, so all of these, you know, aspects are important, you know, to understand what a halo actually is. You know, so for example, things like filaments that we see in simulation, the filaments are, for example, gravitationally bound, they are collapsed. But they're not collapsed in three dimensions, they're collapsed in two dimensions, and so this is how filaments are different than halos. Similarly, things like sheets or voids are also nonlinear structures. Okay, but the aspect here that I want to focus on more is this third aspect, virialization for halos. Okay, so this idea about virialization is a fuzzy concept. Specifically here, what I mean by this is that, you know, virialized regions are multi-streaming, okay? So to illustrate what that multi-streaming idea means, let me just draw another picture, okay? You know, so suppose that we have some, you know, uniform density universe, okay? You know, and suppose that this universe is filled with matter at zero temperature. Okay, so uniform density, zero temperature everywhere. And suppose that we place some little spherical, you know, mass over density inside of that otherwise uniform, you know, zero temperature universe. Okay, and so now what I'll do is, you know, is to plot the phase space around this structure. Okay, you know, so I'll plot as a function of distance from that structure, radius. Okay, so I'll plot the velocity, the relative velocity, the radial velocity between, you know, different mass elements relative to this spherical structure. Okay, so at large distances, the velocity just behaves according to the Hubble flow. Okay, so at large distances, we just have V is equal to HR, where H is the Hubble expansion rate of that universe. Okay, you know, right, you know, with our smaller distances, okay, right, you know, so as you start approaching this gravitating mass at the origin, then we start seeing deviations away from the Hubble flow, okay, and eventually, in fact, even this relative velocity goes negative, okay, crosses through zero, all right, so this point where it crosses through zero, It's called what? Do you guys remember from your freshman cosmology?
Turnaround.
Very good. Yeah. The case is called the turnaround radius. Gold star for Neil. Okay. And so inside the turnaround radius, we have net infall of material towards this gravitating mass. Okay. You know, so stuff which is falling in, is flowing in, it is infalling. And because of gravity, this flow accelerates towards smaller and smaller r, i.e. the velocity gets more and more negative. Okay, so that process continues all the way down to pericenter. Okay, at pericenter. Sorry? It's getting more and more velocity as I go closer and closer. It's accelerating. This is a function of r, not t.
It's going to a finite point. If it gets to a very small, yeah, it should get a very small velocity.
But this is a negative value. And if you like, this is some value of order of the escape velocity from this structure. But again, yeah, it's accelerating. Oh, yes, you're worried about like a point mass?
Yeah, with a point mass.
The point mass, yeah, you know, I mean, right, so it would be Keplerian, it would diverge. Yeah, so here I'm imagining a plausible astrophysical object that has some finite size, a finite density at its core. Yeah. I mean, for all this, it doesn't actually matter. But, okay, right. Okay, yeah. And so all this continues, you know, down here while you are right. So while you are accelerating towards the center, eventually, though, you hit pericenter. Once you pass pericenter, then what happens?
Comes back out
with the exact same velocity. Okay, but now on this side, with the same velocity, okay, you know, but now moving outwards. And so now it's, you know, moving outwards, the radius is now increasing, okay, but now we are decelerating in the same gravitational potential, and so now we slow down, and eventually we hit another turnaround point, and then so on and so on. This process just continues again and again and again as the thing, as these mass elements orbit. Okay, all right, so the multi-streaming region, okay? The multi-streaming region is just everything inside of here, okay? Where we have multiple streams at a, you know, multiple streams of flow, you know, at a given radius, okay? Everything outside of here is just single stream. Inside here, we have multiple streams crossing the same location. Okay, so that's the definition of this multi-stream region. And my claim is that this boundary between the multi-stream region versus the single stream region, this boundary is necessarily what's called a caustic. Okay, so one way to see this just is to plot the physical density as opposed to the phase space density like I plotted here. Okay, you know, so the physical density just corresponds to the projection of this phase space density in the vertical direction. Okay, so if I just plot rho versus r on the same plot, okay, so what you get is that there are these sharp spikes at these caustic locations. Okay, you know, sort of like this. So just try to imagine that these spikes all line up with these locations, okay? So the key thing, just is that wherever this phase space sheet goes vertical, there's a large pileup of mass at that location, okay? you know, lots of particles just happen to be sitting at that one location for a long amount of time. That pile up then gives me this large spike in the density. It's all the physics that's going on here, okay? You know, so these caustics are not gravitationally bound structures. They're just temporary alignments of the positions of particles of orbits within this gravitating system. Okay? Right. Okay, and so the key point, you know, this is that, you know, geometrically you can see that these caustics do indeed correspond to the boundary between the multi-stream and the single stream region. Okay? So this picture that I've drawn, of course, is very idealized, right? So this corresponds to a zero temperature universe, right? You know, this also corresponds to perfect spherical accretion, you know, but instead if we have some sort of like non-zero velocity dispersion, well, all that happens just is that this space-based heat gets mirrored out with some velocity dispersion, okay? This is true everywhere across the entire phase space sheet, right? And so therefore now when I project, you know, all that happens is that therefore this structure gets mirrored out, okay? And so in practice, mainly what happens is that these sharp spikes get erased, okay? But the fall off that you see here, that typically persists. Yeah?
So one, this is assuming that you have a single scale that is non-linear, right? This hasn't taken into account this picture. Does it persist?
Yeah, so this picture corresponds just to one object, one perturbation on top of a background mean universe.
Yeah. One other question that What's the distance between the caustics? What's the distance?
Very good, fantastic. Okay, good, yeah. So just hold that thought. I will go through this in some detail. So just hold that thought. So it's the thing I wanted to mention, though, was that, you know, realistically, we don't expect to see these density enhancements at the caustics, right? So people normally think of caustics as being these spikes of density, but in realistic dark matter halos that have finite velocity dispersion, the enhancements typically get washed out, but these density jumps going from the multi-stream to single-stream region, those jumps persist. Okay, and so therefore at the boundary between the virialized and the unvirialized region, we expect there to be a sharp fall off, a steepening in the density profile. Okay, right. Okay, so the reason why I'm mentioning all of this, you know, is that a couple of years ago, so some of our friends, Andrei Kravtsov, Benedict Diemer, his student, you know, so they were.
So this is 3D
or 2D? This is 3D. But I'm just imagining just pure spherical accretion, just 1D. This is the 3D density as a function of R. Yeah, right.
But we see is in projection.
Typically what we see is projection. These features, as you'll see, show up also in projection.
I guess my point is, if you actually project this, it's a, it is a plot too. It's not sharp.
That might be your belief. That might be your expectation. It turns out to not be true. So when we project these, we do still see the same steepening feature also arising in the two-dimensional projected surface density.
But you don't see a spike.
That's right. The key thing that we don't see in actual realistic halos that have substructure, that have velocity dispersions, is that the smearing of the phase space sheet winds up smearing out these spikes to such a large extent that we don't see them typically. However, though, the smearing is typically not enough to wash out the jumps in the density. Yeah. Okay. Right, okay, so the reason why I'm just going through this, you know, is that a couple of years ago, so our friends Benedict Diemer, yeah?
Yeah. What sets the amount of smearing? It should be the virial velocity.
Velocity dispersion. Exactly.
So for all that matter, I mean, yes, for if you have particle dark matter that has decoupled very early, by today, the velocity dispersion is very, very narrow. So some features should persist.
In the absence of any kind of... So in the absence...
No. That's another thing. I'm talking about this picture when we're discussing it. I thought this is just describing what happens in a single... I agree with you on that.
Yeah.
But the question is, what happens if you have a single lump, a single scale...
Single sump. that has zero temperature, you'll have this picture. Okay, what I'm saying though is that in realistic systems, besides just this one lump, there's also like lots of other small things generating structure. And the main effect of all that small structure for our purposes here is to produce a velocity dispersion.
No, I'm asking a theoretical question. If I had a single, the first structure that ever collapsed,
right.
What is how it should go, like the ratio between the velocity dispersion, the width of how much you suppress,
right.
Should depend on the velocity dispersion over the virial velocity of the structure, right?
Yeah, over something like the escape velocity, the circular velocity. Absolutely, that's right. Absolutely, that's right.
No, but I agree with you. That if you were to take more structures, then
That's right. You know, so in the absence of any kind of like velocity dispersion, say for like the very first thing that forms, so I agree with you that these caustics will be very sharp in 3D. So now when I spherically average to get this profile, you know, the enhancements will only line up at the same radius if the, if the structure, if the flow is perfectly spherical. So if you work through just the Gaussian statistics of peaks of Gaussian random fields, it's typically rare to get exactly spherical peaks, in which case these caustic structures are not exactly round. So therefore, in the spherical average, just the fact that I have some ellipsoidal caustic shape also winds up smearing out these sharp spikes. And so in general, it's really, really difficult to ever find these enhancements of density. Yeah.
But the rarer the peak, the more spherical.
The rarer the peak, the more spherical it is. But even for like 5 sigma peaks, there's enough ellipticity to wash out these things. Yeah. For the one. If we find the 18 sigma peak in the universe, it'll be great. Well, seven is more doable.
So can people, can someone have an estimate on how much the smearing is depending on, let's say you collapse at 1 parsec,
let's say, and
go to 100 kiloparsecs. How does the smearing scale? How deep? Do people have some idea?
So how much does this smearing? So how much smearing do you need to wash out these little density spikes?
How much hierarchical collapse should you get to smear out and get?
So in hierarchical collapse, we never see the spikes. Your question, I think, is more kind of like more academic, right?
Yeah,
right. Yeah, you know. You're just wondering. So how much velocity dispersion on small scale do I need to suppress this enough I don't see it? Yeah. So that's a quantitative question.
Example, have people seen this kind of? Because, well, for example, there can be dark matter models where the scale of where the first scale that collapses is actually quite large.
That's right.
So
things like warm dark matter or something.
Those have large velocity dispersion of warm dark matter.
That's true. That's right. Yes, you want some cutoff in the power spectrum.
There's ideas of quasi dark matter where you have these ultra light fields, and these are very cold.
Yeah, but the Compton wavelength, for the fuzziness would then also...
Yeah, that's true. It would also make it...
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, but surely there is some way to cook up a model that has a cutoff in the power spectrum, put in by hand.
Exactly. Yes, if we put it in by hand.
Yeah.
There's no...
No, yeah, so then I agree. So like the very first thing that forms, if you can keep it spherical enough...
Warm dark matter, the main effect is just the cutoff in the power.
So yes, but the origin, of the cutoff is the streaming motion.
Yeah, but by today, this
it's really small. I agree. However, though, you don't need much to wipe out these spikes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So you're saying that with a few hierarchical mergers.
I've actually computed this with a student. So I should pull up my paper. This is Paco Villascusa, back when I was a postdoc at CETA. We actually literally computed, the collapse of a single warm dark matter halo in the presence of the velocity dispersion, And so for a while, Paco was like really excited about seeing these caustic features. He said, no, this is not an aspect of warm dark matter. I mean, this is just generic. So if I pull up the figure, we can actually maybe find, the spikes. I didn't mean to get off traffic, but for me, this is like the more fun stuff. Let me just relate this now to actual universe. So we have this prediction that at the boundary between the virialized region, the infall region, there should be a sharp steepening feature. Rice's argument is just very simple, hand-wavy theoretical, but in fact it's true. So there was a really nice paper by Andrei Kravtsov and his student Benedict Diemer. So what they did was they took a whole bunch of halos and n-body simulations. And so they just stacked the density profile to get an average density profile around these halos. And indeed, lo and behold, what they found was that at this outskirts, they found this tremendous steepening feature. And so at first they were puzzled about, So at first they were somewhat puzzled about the reason for the steepening feature, but they're based in Chicago and we are neighbors and so we visit them a lot. So they showed us this problem. We said, oh, it's a caustic. And then, they didn't believe us at first, but eventually we convinced them. So that was really exciting. So what this says is that for actual realistic, cosmological dark matter halos, these caustic features should in fact arise. So the next thing was to look for the same kind of features in actual clusters of galaxies on the sky.
It's only the first one that we can see, right?
So typically, we only see this outermost caustic. My student and I did find certain classes of halos where you can see the second one as well. So typically, what you need is to have halos that are very slowly accreting, such that these caustics are spaced out enough that you can separate them.
So it's kind of unusual halos to share the second
one. Yeah, very few of them do. Has to be isolated, has to be really slowly accreting. That's right, yeah. But we showed though in simulations that that there are halos like this where you can see the other caustics as well. So this was all in simulations. And so then following the theoretical work that we did and also that Andre and Benedict did, the next step then that we did was then to actually look for this effect in actual halos on the sky. Okay, so what we did was to observe a bunch of galaxy clusters found in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. We just stacked those profiles, and indeed we found something exactly like this. Okay, and so what this says is that actual galaxy clusters on the sky also have these caustics, present in the distribution of galaxies, also present in the distribution of their mass as seen by lensing.
Can you get some numbers there? How many clusters did you
analyze? Yeah, so we were analyzing about 8,000 clusters. Each one has between 20 and 40 galaxies. Yeah, and so multiply the numbers and you can get the total number of pairs. Yeah.
And what significance was the steepening?
Oh yeah, many sigma. I think it was, so when we subdivided even, it was still above 3 sigma, so then presumably, 5 sigma.
It's a huge assumption there that the galaxies are tracing the mass.
Yeah, very good, exactly, right. So our first detection was just in counting galaxies. Now with DES, I don't believe this is yet published, but DES, we also see this in lensing. Yeah, again, at the same location.
With the same similar number of clusters, huh? Many clusters.
Thousands of clusters, that's right. Yeah.
The same location, you mean this is
Yeah, okay.
Feature
yeah, okay, right, okay. Right, so I'll plot the slope, let's say d log rho d log r versus r, okay? So for like a normal halo profile, like a NFW profile, the prediction for the slope is that it's something like slowly varying, asymptotes to -3. What we see for both the simulations and also for the actual clusters is instead something that looks more like this. Okay? So this is the slope. Okay, so what it says is that there's a narrow range of radii where it gets really steep before then, before then joining back onto, right.
The width of the step matches the predictions of the simulation.
Okay, so the width of this feature depends a lot, mainly it depends upon the range of masses that you're stacking over, right, okay.
So you can't extract it in individual things?
not observationally. In simulations, actually, we can get now the actual 3D caustic structure around individual halos. And these things are not round. You know, they have, you know, ellipsoidal shapes, right? Okay. You know, but yeah, I mean, right. So it's roughly speaking, right, you know, so for the actual Sloan measurements, this width is something like a factor of 2 in radius.
But that matches up what you expect and say, taking some simulations and stacking them.
Hold that thought. Yeah, okay. So I'll say that qualitatively, what we see is something exactly like what we expected. But just hold your thought about the level of matching. Yeah, yeah.
So if you do this analysis, are you really looking at shell function or also the higher order caustics like customs, swallowtails?
Oh, very good. Yeah, okay, yeah. So these all correspond to fold catastrophes. I mean, at least in this spherical picture. You're absolutely correct, though, that if there's a smaller scale structure, which there's like satellites and things like that, a smaller scale structure will break up the fold catastrophes into higher order catastrophes, cusps, swallowtails, et cetera. There's no way I can see for now to actually detect those sort of higher order catastrophes. So again, right?
Observationally.
Again, in simulations, this is quite challenging because we only have a certain number of particles in the simulation. These things are hard enough to see for single halos. And you can't stack to see these higher order catastrophes across a range of halos because the swallowtails, et cetera, those happen in completely random locations. So at present, I don't see a way to see the higher order catastrophes. But yeah, I mean,
that's it. It's a clever thing than stacking.
Absolutely, yes, that's right. So people who are more clever than us, you should absolutely think about this and find, you know, cute things to do with this, you know, with these features. Okay, once again, I'm going 10 times too slow. So simulation paper was Diemer and Kravtsov. Observational paper was by Serhud Moore et al. And a bunch of people, including me and Andre and my students and stuff. Okay, so the physics of this is like just totally trivial to understand. Okay, you know, and so my students and I wrote a paper just explaining, you know, just the physics of you know, these caustics, how they work. It turns out that you can understand everything here just by using spherical collapse. Mm-hmm. Okay, so spherical collapse, of course, is a calculation that everyone here has done in their first year. You know, astronomy course or cosmology course. Everyone here has done first year astronomy.
Kindergarten.
A kindergarten class.
This is the point where the cosmologists in the audience feel so superior.
It's only fair, okay? I mean, today I was hearing all about Bell inequalities. I was feeling so stupid. But now payback. Okay, so just to remind you, what is spherical collapse? Okay, so it's the stupidest thing you can compute. Okay, so suppose you have a spherical mass distribution of mass m. Let's compute the motion of some test particle around it. Okay, the equation of motion for this system is, well, r double dot, the acceleration, is equal to the gravitational acceleration. I mean, this is literally the stupidest thing, gm over r squared. Okay, this is the entire spherical collapse model, entirely. Okay, all of us can solve this really easily. I'll spare you the algebra. Okay, the known solution just has the following behavior. So if I plot r, the separation as a function of time.
And you're assuming that the zero velocity.
No, I'm assuming that I'm starting with the Hubble flow. Okay, the unperturbed universe.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, okay, very good. Okay, right, okay, very good. Right, you know, so the initial condition is just Hubble expansion, okay? But then because of this, you know, deceleration, we eventually break off from the Hubble expansion. We eventually reach some maximum radius, which is called, again?
Turnaround,
yeah, very good. Okay, so this turnaround radius is the exact same as this turnaround radius here. Okay, it's the same picture, just plotted in different ways. Okay, and then following this turnaround, you know, the calculation we all do, that, you know, for this, you know, like, I mean, like, you know, so we show that this particle then is recollapses, you know, on a time equaling twice the turnaround time. Okay, so again, everyone here has done this. Okay, so the one like completely trivial thing that my students and I did then just was to ask, okay, so now following this first collapse, what happens next? Okay, so okay, so all we did just, you know, I mean, right, so all we did then, you know, just simply was to extend this calculation past this point. And what happens? What do you think? Well, the obvious answer just is that this thing just continues to orbit. Okay, that's all that happens, as you might expect. This second turnaround point here, that's just this second turnaround point here. Okay, so the caustic location is just given by the solution to this equation just at this time. Okay, so that was a embarrassingly trivial calculation, but you can show that just by doing this, you can explain all of the morphology seen in these very complicated n-body simulations for the behavior of these caustic features. This is analogous to the Bertschinger solution. What do you mean, Fillmore and Goldreich?
It's more trivial than.
It's even more trivial than the Fillmore, Goldreich, Bertschinger.
Isaac Newton solution.
This is this is the Kepler problem, right? This is the Kepler equation of motion.
Yeah, I guess they both act as a position of
plastics. Yeah, you know, so the Fillmore, Goldreich, the Bertschinger, okay, you know, so all of it is just this. It's just some assumption about the mass profile of this perturber, okay. But none of that really matters for this argument. Mm-hmm. Okay. So just by doing this like one line calculation, you can predict everything about this splashback feature. And so, for example, you know, so we showed that you can completely predict the mass dependence. You can predict the redshift dependence. You can predict the cosmology dependence. You know, okay. Right. So we show that this, you know, this feature depends upon things like dark energy parameters, and then we verified in simulations that in fact, you know, this stupid 1D thing matches, you know, exactly correctly. Okay, and so all this stuff was therefore really easy to understand, much to the chagrin of the simulators who like to pretend that pencil and paper is useless. We have to do supercomputers for everything. Okay, so for us, this was like really fun little cute project for my students, you know, just to sort of get started with science. You know, she got really excited. But besides just being fun for us, you know, I mean, so since I'm here at Perimeter, so maybe I should just describe some of the connections to fundamental physics, if there are any. There's not a lot for these caustics, but there are some possible connections, okay, that I'll just briefly mentioned in the past, and I mean, you know, in like the final few minutes. Okay, so one thing you can think about here related to fundamental physics, you know, is the following fact. Okay, you know, so any effect which can act to slow down this motion coherently will therefore also move the location of this splashback radius, right? You know, so if I make the orbit slower, then this second turnaround point will happen at a smaller radius. It'll happen faster, and so on. Okay. Okay, so anything affecting the orbits can move these features. Okay, so one physical effect that we know has to happen is called dynamical friction. Okay, you know, so this dynamical friction is a effective, you know, gravitational drag acting on massive objects moving through, you know, seas of particles. Okay.
But even before you go there.
Yeah.
The second radius is not going to be the same as first because the mass is changing.
Fantastic. So the main thing we showed in our first paper was that the main quantity affecting the splashback radius is the mass accretion rate, d log m, d log time.
Yeah.
Okay, because as you said exactly. Okay, you know, if the potential were static, each of these subsequent orbits would just be a copy of this first orbit. But if the potential is getting deeper and deeper, what happens? Well, the orbit shrinks, it contracts just adiabatically. Also, the orbital time, the period also gets faster because the density gets higher. And so the dynamical time gets faster for a higher density. Yeah, okay. And so all these things we explain in our first little cute paper on this. But yeah, that's exactly right, okay. Okay, but anyway, so yeah, so getting back to this dynamical friction, right? So this is a gravitational drag acting on massive satellites. Okay, so so like the strength of this friction is a strong function of the mass of the satellite moving through the host halo it's moving in. You know, so typically in simulations, what we find is that this friction is significant. Okay, you know, for satellites whose masses are, let's say, bigger than like a percent of the host mass. Okay, so for satellites this big, we start seeing these friction effects even on single orbits. Okay, right, so the effect of this drag is to slow down the orbits, as I said, thereby making the splashback radius smaller compared to other things which are orbiting which are not suffering this friction. Okay, so I mentioned that this friction is only really effective for the biggest satellites. So therefore, one way to look for this is to compare the biggest satellites compared to all the other smaller satellites. Okay, so that's what we did. So my student and I looked at Sloan clusters. So we looked at the smallest clusters we could find, as well as the biggest galaxies in those smallest clusters. Okay, right, so the idea is to maximize this ratio. And indeed, what we found was that for the biggest galaxies in the smallest clusters, indeed the splashback radius was significantly smaller than the splashback radii for all the other populations of galaxies. Yeah.
Maybe that. So how sharp is this feature? Like can you quantify how usefully you can distinguish these differences? I mean, really, you have to look at extreme differences in the position to see it because the peak is so high.
Yeah, so for our dynamical friction detection, if I recall, the brightest galaxies, their splashback radii were, I think, like 30-40% smaller than the splashback radii for all the other galaxy populations. The width of this feature can be significant, right? But what matters is, but what matters is our ability to centroid this peak.
Yeah, it's a nice shape that you can actually tell the centroid.
Oh yeah, very clearly, because these statistics are so high. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And how does that translate do you get any useful constraints on omega lambda and W from this, or could you potentially?
Yeah, so that was our original hope, okay, right. So our original hope was to use this as a standard ruler, basically, right? Because we know exactly how to predict where it will fall. Modulo effects like this, like friction, which can move the splashback radius for certain subpopulations. But from lensing and for the bulk of the galaxies, we can just measure it directly. They all agree with each other. And so our hope was to use this as a standard ruler. And that didn't work for a reason I'll get into next. Okay, So I mentioned that in Sloan, we were able to measure this feature and more at all. So we had this very significant detection of this feature. I didn't mention, though, that the location of the feature we measured was about 20% smaller than the theoretical prediction. And so we have spent like about a year trying to figure out why that happened.
How significant is that?
Two to three sigma around there. The discrepancy between what we see versus what we expect for halos of this mass.
Do you expect that if you had angular momentum, it could change the?
So these things have angular momentum, right? None of that matters for this. Yeah. The reason for that you can see is the following. Okay, so this feature corresponds to the apocenters of the orbits. Okay, so that's mainly set by the orbital energy. The angular momenta are setting the pericenters of the orbit. Okay, so I can change this pericenter enormously. Okay, it doesn't change the orbital energy, doesn't change the time that it takes for me to go from here to here. Okay, just because the time spent down here is negligible compared to this time.
Have you guys thought about self-interactions?
Very good. So my poor student, okay, so we found this like 20% discrepancy, and so for my poor student, so what I made her do was to, code up all sorts of crazy structure formation simulations. Okay, so first I had her, code up a whole variety of self-interacting dark matter simulations. Okay, so we put in all types of interactions. So we had hard sphere scattering. We also had, long-range forces that can have, velocity dependence. They can also have, strongly anisotropic scattering. All possible things we considered. None of them move this splashback radius. None of them. Everything we tried does not change the splashback radius for reasons I can explain if you're curious.
Is it because it's elastic scattering, so the energy does not change, or is it if you work with...
There's no dissipation per se.
Yeah.
However, though, for some of the models that have, cross-sections that are, cross-sections that are highly peaked towards forward scattering, okay, so since most particles experience many, many of these forward scattering events that are very weak, most particles do experience a drag. And so based on that, we expected to see this feature. However, no change. The reason, I think, is the following, if you're curious, okay? So, so say that you have some halo and you have some particles, SADM particles falling in, okay? So these particles will have a range of pericenters, okay? And since the drag force depends upon how much density you're going through, they experience different amounts of drag, okay? This caustic corresponds to a pileup of the orbits, okay? So to have a caustic, all of these apocenters all have to be at the same place at the same time. So when you have this range of different drags, they're not now all apocentering back at the same place at the same time. Okay, So instead of having a caustic, you just have this, schmear. The only particles that actually retain the caustic are the ones that were on very grazing orbits, which therefore didn't have much drag at all. Yeah, so much to my dismay, SIDM does not fix our problem. Okay, the next thing then that we tried, my poor student, so I made her then, perform lots of modified gravity simulations. So we just did, simulations with F of R and DGP. So I had strong prejudice. I know, but we were desperate, right? Like, what do we do? Desperate times call for desperate measures.
Desperate theories.
Theories. So again, we had some sort of theoretical prejudice that this, F of R, should produce a feature, okay? So my thinking was just the following, okay? Right, so these halos have screened regions and also unscreened regions, okay? So the particles that are passing through a screened region, their orbits might get sped up or slowed down, depending upon the sense of the, sense of the transition. Okay, anyway, yeah, so I just thought that it will be a strong effect. Nothing. No effect on the splashback radius.
Chameleons?
What's that?
Chameleons?
Would F of R count? Would F of R count as chameleon? Yeah. Yeah. So Einstein chameleon. Yes. Nothing that we tried out of our desperation was able to fix this problem.
Does this so you were stacking different objects too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Different masses.
Mm.
Did you try it?
No. So in the Sims we have masses. So therefore, in the Sims, we can just stack on a narrow mass bin.
Oh, so the 20% discrepancy appeared at what masses?
Oh, yes. So that was for the comparison of the actual red mapper clusters.
Yeah.
Those don't have very good masses. We have a plausible range of masses.
Yeah.
And so, right, yeah. So when we compare to the simulations, the mass range we think, corresponds to a factor of four or so in mass. The range in mass is a factor of four. But the mean masses were something 10 to the 14-ish. Right. So 1 to 2, 10 to the 14, roughly speaking. Yeah. So these objects are in fact actual clusters as opposed just to little poor groups. Okay, we're out of time. So I'll just say that for now. We have this little puzzle. We don't really understand what's going on.
What you don't understand is why it is so insensitive to anything.
The SIDM, I understand, I think, why it's not sensitive for this argument. The modified gravity, we haven't really thought. Yeah. The one thing that we found it to be sensitive to was things like dark energy parameters. However, though, the allowed range of W is nowhere near large enough to explain the magnitude of this.
So you see this both in the lensing and in the galaxy count.
The lensing splashback is at the same location as the galaxy counts.
Within the required precision to say it's off from the simulation.
Yeah, well, the lensing error bars are quite a bit larger than the galaxy error bars. Yeah, you know, I mean, okay, yeah. So the statement...
It's a galaxy count problem rather than a lensing problem.
It's a much stronger problem, yeah, I would say, you know, in terms of the galaxy discrepancy.
So how many objects do you have? It's related to this. How many objects do you have? Have you exhausted all the... Is this... So could you... If you had a more sensitive probe...
If we had only another survey that could find more clusters. Well, fortunately... luckily for us, you know, a number of institutions are in fact running large imaging surveys that also follow findings like this. So my institution, Illinois, is heavily involved in the dark energy survey. We are running the same cluster finding algorithms to find larger samples of clusters. The Japanese have the Hyper Suprime Cam survey. Yeah, so there's plenty more objects like this that we can find in the near future.
Will this shrink also the error bars because of this counting?
Yeah, so statistics will help shrink the error bars. Another nice thing about these upcoming surveys relative to Sloan is that they are much deeper, so we get many, many more galaxies around the clusters. Yeah, so we should... Oh, and also the lensing, of course, will improve a lot, okay? I mean, right, because in Sloan, this, you know, this feature was not seen in Sloan lensing. We've only seen it in this preliminary DES lensing.
Do you have a picture of that? Can you show us?
Of which?
Just so that we can see that from a lensing measurement?
Oh no! The DES lensing I cannot show because it is proprietary. I shouldn't even be. This is not even being recorded, right? So it's fine, right?
You can say whatever you want.
Yeah, yeah.
It is being recorded. That's why I have that.
Oh, I assumed it was just to broadcast my voice. Okay, so in which case, I disavow everything I just said last hour. It was all lies to make you guys work on the wrong areas of physics. And if you're curious, I can show you some, you know, offline.
Just real quick, the real world is 20%, the splashback is 20%.
Smaller. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Does it depend on the type of the galaxies?
No, except for just the very brightest galaxies in the very smallest clusters. Okay, only for that one subset of a subset do we see this, you know, this shift, which we are pretty confident is due to dynamical friction. Oh yeah. So the reason why I mentioned this at all, okay, you know, is that this friction effect normally is computed assuming particle dark matter. Okay, so it's not clear to me what'll happen in some of these crazy theories without particle dark matter. Would you expect the same kind of dynamical friction effect? I don't know. Is there something?
Langhui had they said in this fuzzy dark matter.
Fuzzy dark matter. Is it still particle dark matter? Yeah. But again, these are still particle dark. Okay, yeah. So right. So my level of craziness is past your level of craziness, I guess, right? I mean, right. So I'm just thinking of like these things like Mond, or for example, locally you guys have some favorite things like Mog. So I was just wondering if you know these sort of theories without dark matter entirely, would they give this sort of dynamical friction effect? Because the effect is calculated assuming a sea of particles that you are focusing behind you. And so if you don't have those particles, I actually have no idea what will happen with this friction effect.
Already have a different discrepancy for that's a much bigger effect.
So I'm actually pretty confident that is not anything physical. You know, so my strong belief is that this discrepancy just is due to a selection effect in our clusters.
Would that be different in different settings?
So the way to check this is to find clusters using, you know, not galaxies but some other method. Okay. So the problem here, you know, is that in Sloan we are finding these clusters by counting galaxies. Then we then measure this feature by counting galaxies,
yes.
And so therefore your selection effect could introduce an artifact.
Right.
So what my student is supposed to be doing right now, I don't know if she is, but she's supposed to be taking the Planck you know, the Planck cluster sample and doing the same thing. So Planck is as z-selected, so therefore all these issues should not be present. You know, so based on plots we've seen, there is clearly a splashback feature. You know, so I mean, so next step now just is to now compare to where it should be given the expected masses of the Planck clusters. But we haven't yet done that yet because she's off enjoying life now that she has a job.
Can you look at splashback on smaller scale halos like galaxies?
Yeah, very good. So the same physics applies in galaxies. In practice, it's usually harder to see this feature in galaxies for the following reason. You know, so if you're familiar with the language of the halo model, no? Okay, so halo, so clustering of mass around halos has two contributions we think of, okay? Okay, you know, so the mass around halos has a, you know, the one halo term, which is just the mass profile of the one halo itself. There's also, however, you know, other neighboring halos that are correlated with this halo. Okay, they have mass of their own. That term, okay, right? You know, so that term is called the two halo term, and this, and typically this term picks up on some large scale. Okay, so for clusters of galaxies, this one halo term is really, really big because the mass is really big. You know, so this one halo term dominates a lot over the two halo term, such that this splashback feature is seen before the two halo term kicks in. For galaxies, unfortunately, this two halo term is larger, and so therefore the expected splashback radius falls in the noise of this two halo term. And so we don't expect to be able to see this necessarily for galaxies and stacking without doing something clever that we haven't thought of yet. But you're right though, the exact same physics is also applying there in galaxies. Yeah. Yeah, you know. So
but
part of the reason
you said you need to select galaxies that happen not to have many.
That's true. Yeah, that's right. That is one way. Yeah, that is what, you know, that is one possible way to do this. You know, so part of the reason why, like, you know, lots of the galaxy people and the simulation people have gotten really excited about this, you know, so part of the reason is that this radius, this caustic or splashback radius, now gives you a really precise boundary between inside versus outside halos. So for people who care about like galaxy formation physics, this is really useful. So for example, we have shown that the colors of galaxies change like sharply, almost discontinuously at the splashback radius. The morphologies of galaxies change at this particular radius. So what this says is that entering a cluster does something to galaxies, and that's just, you know, interesting for the galaxy formation people.
Defining
what the clusters. Exactly.
That's
very nice. Oh, right. Yeah.
Can you look at the gas properties at different radii and see if the gas properties change as well, or do you not see that far out?
Well, we haven't looked at everything yet. I mean, so all this is just at the past few months. Right. You know, the main thing we've checked is just galaxy colors. So if you plot things like the red fraction of galaxies as, you know, as a function of radius, okay. I mean, right. You know, so what's known is that out in the field away from clusters, most galaxies are blue. The red fraction is maybe like 30-40%. Inside of clusters are mainly red galaxies. What we see is that there is a incredibly sharp transition, which is exactly at the splashback radius. Yeah,
but
I know.
You've got to get fancier because they're not really spherical. So presumably the transition happens at the radius, not the fixed radius.
So of course, there's some curvature here.
Yeah. If you look at 3D.
Oh, so this is all in stacks. This is all in stacks.
Right.
Yeah.
Same. In principle, one should do better than stacking in radius.
Oh, yeah. So if we had infinite numbers of galaxies, of course we would just look at individual.
Not infinite. I mean, surely the clusters are not very spherical.
I agree, they're not very spherical.
So
they don't have a lot of galaxies.
Be a better way to snap.
Great. Yeah, so you should think about this. And then let us know how to do it. It would be great. And so far, our stuff is all just based on stacking.
Right.
But you're absolutely right, though, that individual objects will have this boundary around them.
Right.
And so Andre and his student are thinking a lot about, you know, trying to actually see this boundary for individual objects. Yeah, so that is true.
So I guess one issue I understand, but one issue that people were thinking about at AXCO, which they think a lot about, is this issue of whether it's strangling. So galaxies that fall into the cluster that stop forming a star.
Absolutely. And so these sort of observations I'm pretty sure we'll answer this question. So my student actually has a paper on this coming out relatively soon once she finishes her like goofing off. So I'm pretty sure that actually, you know, our measurements, you know, strongly favor models in which entry into the cluster is killing the galaxies after some amount of time.
But then, so what it does is it affects, so the profile of galaxies will be different from the profile of the dark matter because...
The profile of the blue galaxies will be different than the profile of the dark matter, for example, because the blue galaxies turn red.
But all of them would be different, but if you're converting one type to another type, so...
Yeah.
So that's the question is that... I mean, there are two things. Did you break it?
I don't know how expensive these things are. Hopefully you won't. So you take it out of my stipend.
Anyways, so I'm just saying that there are two effects. The color of axis evolve.
Yeah, the colors we see change, the morphologies also we see change. So for example, we see that, you know, galaxies become much less clumpy inside versus outside.
But that would affect their, the structure of the density profile.
Well, so we're not destroying galaxies, right? We're just turning them from blue to red.
The accelerate has some selection, so you basically see things.
So I should make clear. All these counts, these are all for volume-limited samples, right? So not flux-limited or anything. Yeah, these are all volume-limited samples.
Okay.
Yeah, over all the colors, yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
So I think we better call it hold.
Okay.
Feel is around until the
3 more hours, yeah.
And
sorry for...
So it's, thank you for the...